tasty.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another one of my talks with Todd Lewis here. Recently, I had some German guests on who were talking about European security. They had quite an anti-Russian point of view, as well as an anti-American point of view, which was interesting to say the least, but I think they tended towards NATO, and that, as often with political opinions, divided the comments. I'm not sure where I stand on these things. I tend to think that Europe is caught between a rock and a hard place with America and Russia, and some sort of robust answer to both would be optimal. But then there are all sorts of question marks about how you get there from the current present, because Europe is at a low ebb right now. They talk about China's century of humiliation. In my view, Europe has kind of been in a bit of a century of humiliation itself since World War II. But Todd, as an American, it must be noted, has some thoughts on this. Before we get going, Todd, where can people find you?
You can follow me at PLF Podcast on X, and you can follow me on YouTube, Praise the Folly Podcast.
And I will just remind people, promo code SHORJAN gets you 25% off all courses. Buy it now. There's Trivium, there's Foundations of Entrepreneurship, there's Foundations of Politics with promo code SHORJAN. I just thought of doing this. Look, promo code SHORJAN. Sure. So I don't have to play the ad. So obviously, since Russia's invasion or special mission or whatever they call it, the SMO, the Special Military Operation in Ukraine, the question of European security has become more and more acute. It's also been heightened in the news recently with Trump going on and on about taking Greenland. Why that's important is because in our media, Todd, they've gone absolutely crazy about this. The European leadership, Keir Starmer included, basically see this as an existential threat to NATO, which is the alliance between America and all of the European powers that has held since World War II, against Russia primarily. So that's why that's important. You have thought about the geopolitical context, and you may have a slightly unusual answer to Europe's general security problems. Take it away.
All right. So if we look at Europe as both a continent and now as a political entity, which sort of is divided between NATO and the EU, and they're still trying to figure out what this entity is going to look like. And there has been talk about an EU army. So what that means for NATO is another question. But if we use the science of geopolitics and we look at Europe as a continent, it has one, and specifically its threat to the East, Russia, has a very big problem. There is the North European plain. So if you imagine a triangle where the third tip point is pointing this way, and
hold
then
on, Todd, just bear with me, sorry. Sorry about that little interruption there, Todd, but as you were saying.
Right, so if we look at Europe's security needs and Russia's security needs from a purely geographic point of view, and we use the science of geopolitics, we notice that the North European plain, which the further east you go, the wider it gets, is indefensible. It's completely flat. And say from modern Russian statehood around the time of Frederick the Great down till today, Russian armies go west and European armies go east. And whoever wins these conflicts, not always Russia, for example, World War I, it's very expensive and costly, even for the winner, right? And so the idea then is the correct geopolitical solution to this security threat is closer cooperation between Europe and Russia, because this is just not defensible. And so what's the cost now? Well, there's a war in Ukraine going on right now. But what it does is it adds the military costs of preparedness. It adds the costs of actually fighting. And even if you win, say Russia in World War II, catastrophic losses were incurred by that. Now, Guillaume Fay, in his Archaeofuturism, imagines a future society called Euro-Siberia, which when I first heard about it, I thought was pretty trippy. Like, what's Euro-Siberia? And he makes more of a, he doesn't really make a geopolitical argument. He's sort of more of esoteric. So he's appealing to some sort of esoteric traditionalism or something, I guess. But his instincts, I think, are sound. Now, he says in Archaeofuturism, he gets this idea from Dugin, which is weird because Dugin doesn't really openly support an idea of Euro-Siberia, at least not that I'm aware of. But I think that that's a nice title for this concept called metapolitical concept of European-Russian cooperation. Because if we look at the current political landscape, Russia is more of a junior partner to China. Europe is more of a junior partner to the U.S. And they can't really rely on China and or Russia or U.S. to be reliable to them, because in any alliance, the junior partner has to just kind of do what the other partner tells it to do. Whereas Russia and Europe, both being junior partners, are less unequal in power than they would be with Russia and China and the U.S. and Europe. So that when they form an alliance, if they take my advice and form an alliance, then that would lead to less, it'd be harder to break. Because, right, if you have two parties and one party's obviously stronger than the other, it's very easy for that stronger party to just one day tear up the contract and lean on the other guy, which is what Europe, I think, is afraid Trump is doing right now. Furthermore, they would have a tremendous vested interest in continuing to keep the North European plain, kind of like Eurasia's Canada, the longest undefended border. It isn't now, but it could be one day. And I believe that would be the correct geopolitical answer to both Russia and Europe's security concerns. Now, the obvious objection is, well, there's a war going on in Ukraine, and these people don't seem to like each other very well. Well, there was another geopolitical puzzle that was solved that took a long time to solve. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, France and Germany should have been working together against Russia to the east and the Atlantic powers to the west, because Russia can go all in for the army, Britain and America all in for the Navy. France and Germany are going to have to split their funding between whoever the two is, plus fight each other. That didn't work out too well, even though, you know, France won both world wars. It was devastated. And then when the European Union's formed, they're like, no, we're going to do both. We're going to put them together again. That's why there's the Charlemagne Award, the Charlemagne Prize. And so if France and Germany, after decades of mutual hostility and world war, could come together and solve this geopolitical security puzzle by working together to form the European Union, I don't see why in principle that couldn't happen between Europe and Russia.
Now, this is very interesting, because all of this was talked about, Todd, in the early days of Vladimir Putin. He actually wanted to join NATO and was encouraged by the likes of Tony Blair and various other leaders at that time, in the early 2000s, late 90s, 1999, 2000 sort of time. You know, there was an attempt to bring Russia in. Putin wanted to join NATO, basically was told he couldn't. Then, as Vladimir Putin tells it, feels that he was double-crossed by George W. Bush, which then set him on a rather different course. Then there was Chechnya, then there was Georgia, then there was Ukraine. Now Russian relations with Europe are at the lowest point, arguably, since World War One, or since like the apex of the Cold War or something, or, you know, we're on the cusp of a hot war between Russia and Europe again. Russia is very close to China now. So all of this stuff has been discussed. In fact, I have a book here, an old book, which actually it's got question marks over it, because it talks about Khazar theory and so on. I can't remember what it's called. It's called the Iron Curtain, or the Iron Wall around Europe. I forget who wrote that now, but I remember in that book starts with a very long kind of history of saying, well, actually the natural thing to do from kind of the common sense thing to do is for Germany and Russia to come together, okay? And you can actually see why, from a from a land point of view, it would make sense because they wouldn't have to worry about defending on that side and this constant threat of invasion from Russia. And also the Russians wouldn't have to worry about their west flank anymore, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The problem is, Todd, that the British empire, the British interest in Europe has never been this. They see themselves as a sea power. This is Mackinder, the Mackinder Doctrine, as it was known. And he argues, like, look, yeah, there are these land powers, okay, whoever controls the heartland controls the world and all of this. And as a sea power, what Britain has got to do is to make sure that that alliance that you're talking about doesn't happen. We have to do anything possible to create a buffer zone between Germany and Russia to stop this juggernaut forming. Otherwise, we lose the map. And my understanding is that this thinking from the British Empire, from Mackinder, has carried forward into the American Empire and is still largely dominant in Washington, which is why, I mean, there could be other ethnic reasons there as well, but a lot of the historical anti-Russian sentiment that has long been British foreign policy was basically inherited wholesale by American foreign policy, because in the Mackinder Doctrine, America is also a sea power, not a land power, because the key landmass is Eurasia. And they're basically working, Britain and America are always working to prevent the map being taken by this. Because if it forms, if the Germany-Russia juggernaut forms, you know, pretend you're playing diplomacy or risk or something, how do you stop it? So that's the counter argument. And that's basically been the establishment foreign policy position in this country and in America going on 100 plus years at this point. What's your answer to all of that? I mean, is that not sound logic if you're playing as a sea power, not a land power?
Well, this then brings up the question, where does Europe sit in this, right? Because if you have like the thessalocracies of the United Kingdom and the United States, from their geopolitical point of view, that would be the sensible thing to do. And of course, Europe being divided, France often allied with these powers in the two world wars, for example. Now, in fact, it was France that was the first state to disrupt such an alliance. So Bismarck, who had very sound political instincts, created the Three Emperors League, Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Russia. This was the first time anything like this was actually happened. Now, this was an alliance between three kingdoms. Russia ends up backing out and then later allies with France. And then the Great War happens and the rest is history. But again, as far as I can tell, Bismarck was not making a specific geopolitical commentary on this. But again, he had sound instincts. And, you know, you see this Ostpolitik recur with like Willy Brandt during the Cold War. And so the idea is, yes, there are lots of political reasons why this hasn't happened. You have Pan-Slavism in Russia, where they wanted to expand westward, which, of course, ran into Austria-Hungary and the Ottoman Empire, and then that led to conflict with Germany. But if we look at this purely as a geopolitical puzzle, that is the correct answer. The question is, what does Europe and Russia want to do with this? Well, Russia clearly is a land power, not a sea power. Europe, I don't think, knows what it is, actually. I think it's been pulled in both directions because it receives pressure from both sides. It receives pressure from Russia to the east, and it receives pressure from the Atlantic powers to the west. Now, what we have seen over the last, say, 100 years is ties to the Atlantic powers. France allies with Britain, with the Entente, and then in World War II, and then post-World War II with NATO. And that seemed to be the correct answer for Europe at the time. But of course, at the end of World War II, most of Eastern Europe was subjugated by the Soviets and then East Berlin and East Germany. But now that Europe is attempting to form a unified political whole, and the United States is less willing, in fact, the Trump administration has said, you can't really rely on us to fight against the Russians if the Russians attack. Well, now we have a real question here. What is Europe's real interest in all this? Because as far as the track record, the United States is just leaving you holding the bag. It says it's going to be there for you, but now it's like, well, no, we're not going to be there for you. The other thing, too, is the Caspian Report did an interesting video on was Macron. And he said that prior to the war in Ukraine, Macron was pushing for a broader European-Russian collaboration. And, of course, one has to wonder if the Ukraine crisis was intentionally drummed up in order to forestall such an effort. Remember, before, and I'm of the opinion that the United States destroyed the Nord Stream pipelines, before that happened, Germany was very close to Russia based on energy needs. So we could also layer onto this resources, right? Okay, well, why should such an alliance form? Well, energy resources from Russia are consumed in Europe. And so there's all sorts of reasons why it would be in the interest of Europe and Russia to form such a alliance or such an or understanding. Bismarck is, as far as I can tell, the first man to come up with this principle. And, you know, and then Guillaume Fay gives a more esoteric reading of it. But just from the geography, this is, I think, the correct answer to the problem. And if France and Germany can overcome decades of animosity to form the European Union, again, that would have been almost inconceivable in, say, 1930, right? It's inconceivable. Nobody would have predicted that. But then 20 years later, it happens.
Yeah, I mean, on the French, it's important to understand. And again, I wish I could remember the name of this book. What's it called? I think it's literally just called The Iron Curtain Over Europe. From the French point of view, it's important to understand that their traditional enemy in Europe was also the British. And it was prior to the 20th century, the British policy actually went the other way. It was like, okay, let us actually ally with the Germans or whatever power was there in Germany and all of these other powers to basically create a problem for the French. I mean, the entirety of the Napoleonic Wars are Britain using various proxy forces to weaken the French, weaken Napoleon, grind them down, and then eventually the British come in themselves. I think if you count it, it's like the seventh war that France had to fight in a row, and then the British win. So they use all of these alliances and so on in order to manufacture that situation. This was the whole issue with Brexit in this country, which is that there was a thinking after World War II, some people thought, well, Britain's future lies in a unified Europe, and Britain has to be have a seat at the table in order to kind of keep an eye on what the French and the Germans are up to. And again, it sounds boomerish from a certain point of view, but a lot of the arguments were, look, we have to keep an eye on the European Union because it could end up being a Fourth Reich, right? I.e., it could end up being a German project for hegemony in Europe. Another strain of it is, well, it's also a French project. We have to keep an eye on it to stop Napoleon reforming. So British foreign policy is always, you want to stop Napoleon, you want to stop Hitler, or whoever it is, right? These are just two symbols of France and Germany. But, you know, centuries of foreign policy of Britain is basically do whatever you can to fuck that up, okay? And for whatever reason, Brexit happens. Now I look back on Brexit, and again, without being too conspiratorial, I think various moneyed interests wanted to take us towards a more global Britain, but also a more Americanized, like an even more American Britain, away from Europe and towards America. Your Tory types, your Jacob Rees-Mogg and so on, they have a different vision. Your libertarians, they were very keen on all of this. And in that, it was coded. The EU is communist. The EU, has a lot of red tape. It's stopping us doing what we want to do. The counter argument, I voted Remain, by the way. And the reason I voted Remain is because on the eve of the vote, David Cameron gave this speech and he said, look, World War II was only so long ago. And if we take this step, this is the first step on the way back to wars coming back to Europe, is what he said at the time. And I was thinking, there is something to this, okay? Also, I was in the process of selling and buying a property. and I thought it would adversely affect my property prices. You know, always be the most selfish with your vote, in my view. If democracy is a sham, at least get a decent house price. It doesn't matter because we voted Brexit in this country. That doesn't stop the basic problem, though, Todd, is that even if the French and the British want to do this, even if the French and the Germans want to have this alliance and pursue this plan, the British are still there. They're still on the map. They're still going to be a problem. They're still going to stick their nose in, and the Americans even more so. So I guess the real question is, how do Germany, France, Russia bring this about if you have really entrenched vested interests in Britain and in America who are hell-bent on stopping it happen no matter what?
Well, I think that's actually the first point is, if you were like, say, Louis XIV, or you were Napoleon, or you were the Kaiser, or you were Hitler, you didn't actually know necessarily that this whole behind-the-scenes apparatus existed to keep Europe divided. I think part of the problem was a lot of these political players in Europe didn't realize that England was playing such a radically different game. And it's in telling, too, that the Franco-German collaboration, which later became the foundation for the European Union and also NATO, is that the British Empire was fatally weakened after World War II, and that it was in the interest of the United States that it happened, because the United States wanted a stronger European core to resist the Soviets. Now, England is, I do not think, in a position to really disrupt this alliance. It's the United States. And I think we saw that with the lead up to the Ukraine war, the attacks on the Nord Stream pipeline. Now, one of the things is the United States doesn't, I think we all agree the United States is in withdrawal. It's weakening. It doesn't have the same kind of hard power it did in 2003 with George W. Bush. And then that part of it is the sort of downsizing of U.S. presence in NATO and demanding European powers spend more money. Now, the issue is that's because a lot of the U.S. security apparatus is focusing on China at the moment as the greater threat. So the real question is, in Dune, the first book, and in the movie, David Lynch, when Paul is being told about the plan, the plot in Arrakis, Thufir says, well, look, you know, the first way to avoid a plot is to know that it's been set. And so he knows that it's, so if you now know that this is how the Atlantic powers play, that's the first step. And that when they're pitting you against each other, you're playing their game. And then second of all, you need to point out the fact that Europe really does need to decide what it is, because Europe is a rimland power. Europe has, so you have the heartland power, Russia and Central Asia, which is primarily land. You know, the Atlantic powers, which is the United States, Great Britain, depending on how you want to slice it, maybe Japan, because it's also an island power. Europe is a rimland power, which means it has access to the sea and access to the heartland. And it's pulled in those two directions. So it's going to have to either side with the heartland power or the Atlantic power in order to ensure its security interests. Of course, the advantage of siding with a heartland power like Russia is that it's right on your doorstep. It can mobilize divisions and tanks and just attack you. And Atlantic power has to build a large apparatus of shipping and naval power to then attack you. And until the United States, it didn't really do it directly. Britain intervened on the periphery in most of these wars you talked about, AA. Only with the U.S. and its massive industrial and population base can like a direct D-Day style attack occur. But that's going to be easier to defend against than a Russian attack from the east. So what I would argue is that Europe needs to decide, is it being a rimland power, is it in its interest to side with the Atlantic powers? That's what they've been saying for the last 80 years. Or with the Eurasian power, Russia. Now, that tradition goes all the way back to Bismarck. And given that, you know, Europe kind of went to pieces after Bismarck's security app structure was dismantled, I think we need to think about that.
When I had my German guests on a couple of weeks ago, Consequent Fry is the name of the channel. There were these two guys on, and they were pretty Russophobic, I would say. And they they basically have a classical German antipathy to the Slav. I'll just put it that way. A kind of ethnic animus that exists, not just between the German and the Russian, but also the Slav. They weren't that kind about the Poles either, it has to be said. How would you overcome this, what appears to be ethnic or racial animus that exists between the Germans and the Russians? And probably at this point, after years now of vilification, both in the Cold War and in the Putin era, I can imagine there are lots of Russians who don't have any love lost for Europeans, given all the shit that's been talked about them. How do you overcome this problem? Because on paper, it looks like a good idea, but, you know, in practice, these two people hate each other.
Well, I think then looking at the last time this sort of geopolitical puzzle was solved, with Germany and France realizing that the correct answer to their security needs was closer collaboration right after World War II, is that that's going to be our guidelines. So what happened? Well, okay, Germany lost World War II. Hopefully it won't come to that. But they, you know, it's ironic and counterintuitive how a world war, even if you win like France, you're on the winning side, I mean, can get you to realize, hey, you know what? We don't really want to do this again. We can't actually afford to do this again because of the costs involved. Now, Europe and Russia, like much of the world, have declining populations. I think that's a pretty – so the demographic pressure tells me that you can't afford to do this again. If you do this again, this might be the end for both you people, because you're already in a tailspin of demographics. You're going to send the young men out to go die so they can't reproduce. Like, that's just suicide at the point that where we're at in Europe and America – or Europe and Russia, where you have TFRs, you know, below 2.1 in almost all of these countries. That's game over. So that would be one pressure. Second pressure is
to cut you off here, Todd. Again, in the interest of devil's advocate, I can imagine some kind of NAFO type, right? Someone who's very gung-ho about these sorts of things say, well, okay, you say that, but last time we had a world war, it resulted in the baby boom. So wouldn't having a big old, massive, old-fashioned war actually result in a massive increase in fertility, given what happened last time? You know, a generation was lost between World War I and World War II, and the actual upshot was a baby boom. Counter. How do you take that?
Yeah, well, that was before the pill. That was 1945. That was before, and then the boomer period is 1945-1965. Right, so literally 5 years after the pill was invented is when the baby boom generation ends. And so that and a whole bunch of other adjacent technologies and social expectations have kicked in that I would argue would mean we should not expect a baby boom. In fact, we didn't have a baby boom after the end of World War One. After the end of World War One, there wasn't a baby boom. See, the baby boom was a result of the security apparatus of that existed in Europe afterwards, even though there was a Cold War, of course, it didn't turn hot, and the Warsaw Pact and the NATO forces did not actually end up fighting each other. That's a big part of it. And I think also, too, it's the crime of leadership. So, for example, I think a lot of European leaders and Russian leaders today just have to pass on before that can happen. Because, you know, if you look at, like, say, World War One, leading up to World War One, with the French revanchism, that leadership class, it would have been impossible to have broader Franco-German collaboration. With that class in charge, it would have been impossible because they were the generation that lost Alsace-Lorraine and wanted it back. So you'd have to wait for a new political crop to develop. That's also probably likely. Like you said, Putin at this stage is probably not very interested in such a thing, even though it would be in the long-term interest of Russia to do so. And Germany, of course, didn't really want to get involved in Ukraine, where it famously just drug its feet this whole time. The whole Ukraine conflict seems kind of contrived from an Anglo-American Atlanticist perspective, because it does really upset this particular geopolitical reshift But I think ultimately it will happen. And I think it will happen because Russia, Germany, and France got over their issues, because geography trumped their political and racial animus.
So I also cut you off. You were going to make a second. Was that the second point you were going to make before?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just trying to think, like, why hasn't this happened? Like, you know, it looked like it could have happened for a moment there when you had Hitler in Germany and Stalin in Russia, and they made the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. That broke down. Ultimately, Hitler invaded Russia. He invaded the Soviet Union. And you could say, well, look, at that moment, you got, you know, an unchecked, i.e., you can't say Hitler was being controlled by the British or the Americans. You can't say Stalin was being controlled by the British or the Americans. They were both relatively autonomous, dictatorial leaders and expressions of their, I don't know, national spirit or something. And they still, even though they had the idea for this pact, it still broke down and they still ended up at war. How could you convince anyone all of this just wouldn't happen again? Like, when has this ever actually happened? Given, I mean, the geography hasn't changed, but yet it seems like the juggernaut never forms. Or something always happens to make sure that they're on opposite sides. Other than this very brief period under Bismarck, when else has it happened?
Well, Bismarck is the only time it's happened. But that ended because ultimately Russia backed out and decided to pivot towards France. In the case of that failure, and then also the Soviets under Stalin, they still had ambitions of territorial conquest in Central Europe. And while Prussia, Germany was satisfied, you know, under Bismarck, Russia was not. And then, of course, both Hitler and Stalin are unsatisfied with the way the geography has been divvied up in that part of the world. Now, I would argue it's the reason why we haven't seen it yet is it's a relatively recent concept. It's not even 200 years old. You know, the idea, the sort of, I guess you could say, metapolitical birth of Euro-Siberia was Bismarck's Three Emperors League. That was like the 1870s. So, and that was the height of great power politics. So there is a countervailing force involved here where we have national interests and we're going to fight other nations for those interests. And so it fell apart. And then after World War II, you see two blocks develop, the capitalist bloc and the communist bloc, who are trying to build a broader security superstructure within their respective spheres. But of course, those two spheres are in conflict. The European Union, of course, develops out of the Western project and then NATO and NATO Western expansion. And that was successful because the US won the Cold War. Now, what I would argue is that really it's only after 1945 that Germany and France get over their issues and work together. So I would argue that the metapolitical concept is not developed enough. There's still these older priors that European and Russian powers have that get in the way. But Franco-German collaboration presently shows us that these priors can be overcome.
Let's just go back to Mackinder and also the current situation. I mentioned the Poles just now. Part of the Mackinder doctrine was to keep these buffer states in the middle independent. Ukraine actually is one of them now, right? But there's, you know, there's Hungary, there's Poland, basically any country in between Germany and Russia. Keep them independent as a buffer. The trouble is that partly owing to various occupations that have happened, like in the history of Poland, or partly as a result of deliberate outside interest. I mean, I think you could argue that the Americans have fostered a certain type of patriotism and jingoism in Poland, which exists, but it's been played up and leaned into. Hungary as well, Orban is there, but I think there's a reason that it's Hungary. I there's a reason that it's Orban in Hungary and not Orban in, I don't know, Portugal or something. Portugal's insignificant when it comes to this, whereas they care about these buffer states. My question is, Todd, even if you overcame all the other things, how do you overcome the strength of feeling in those buffer nations? those nations don't like the Russians, but also if there was questions of the Germans coming in, I can imagine that would foster old feelings too. They're not well disposed to their neighbours west or east, and partly that is deliberate British-American, Anglo-American design, you could say, to prevent this actually happening. Go on.
Well, okay, yeah. Again, Poland and Germany are two good examples as well. They are historically at odds. I mean, Germany invaded Poland in 1939, right? But with the eastward expansion of NATO, rather, and the European Union, Poland and Germany seem to be getting along relatively well. They seem to have been able to overcome these. You could even go back to the first partition of Poland between Russia, Austria, Hungary, and Prussia. But Germany and Poland seem to have overcome those tensions in the same way that Germany and France have. So using those two as template models to look at, one could speculate and theorize that Poland and Russia could do that as well. Now, of course, what happened after 1945 and then with Poland after 2000 is you have a change in the political classes. These are just not the same political classes that were in power before, who would have actively stood in the way of such a unity. As I said, the political class of France in 1914, no way. You're just not going to have broader Franco-German cooperation with that political class in power because of what it represents. And so I think we'd have to learn from those two earlier examples, Franco-German and then Polish-German collaboration, to then build on that and say, how could Russia be induced into this? And how could the fears of Russian conquest and annexation that many of those Eastern European countries grow up with can be allayed as well? So part of it was within the broader European security system, Germany wasn't going to go around invading these countries, or France, right? The two former great powers that formerly invaded all their neighbors. The buy-in was that they weren't going to do that anymore, and that these other smaller, minor nations would also benefit from the security umbrella. So in the same way that France and Germany, who used to go around invading their neighbors, were convinced to stop, you'd have to convince the Russian political class to do that too. I think it's possible, because there's one thing that's very different now about Russia than Russia of 200 years ago. It's in a demographic death spiral. You don't have these human wave Russian steamrollers anymore that you did in World War I or II, because they just don't have the manpower. And you know, another war like that might be the end. So you could leverage that and say, hey, look, we Europeans can't do this either. It's a both and. They both can't really do this again. The real winner in such a conflict would probably be Turkey. They just sit on the sidelines and watch these two powers blow each other away. So, which would then open the gates up to Islam, which is what both sides don't want.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, given this scenario you've laid out, Todd, and I'm thinking outside the box a little bit, if you were America, would it not behoove your interests to foster anti-globalist nationalism to keep the nations divided at this time, to see globalism? Because what you're talking about actually is a version of quote-unquote globalism, okay, because it's not nationalistic. It's putting aside of national differences in the past and are coming together. It's somewhat like an expanded EU that goes all the way to the edge of China, right? From the American point of view, this is a disaster. So if you're America, surely you'd just promote nationalism and even populist nationalism in all these places, which I would argue they have actually done. Elon Musk and Donald Trump and Peter Thiel and all these projects and all the Zionist network that we talk about in Europe. Well, if they're promoting anti-EU nationalism, it basically makes all these plans you're talking about impossible.
Well, it makes it very difficult. But there's one advantage now that we have that earlier, let's call them victims of this play, didn't have. One, we have knowledge. We know that this play is actually happening. So if you were like Europeans in World War One, you wouldn't, unless you were like, you know, high up in their respective State Departments, you wouldn't really know this. And then furthermore, because we live in a digital age where knowledge is distributed and easier to access, we can also see them say this. I mean, they don't really hide this as much as they used to anymore. They don't really hide behind the same kind of rhetoric of democracy and, you know, peace that they did in World War One or World War Two. And I think that we're getting to a point where a level of consciousness is developing where these kinds of tricks are no longer going to be as effective. We can think of this in terms of peak energy, like behind the peak oil idea. There's a peak in consumption and then it trails off. You could say this with the regard to the law of diminishing returns. The more you do something over time, the less you get out of it. And eventually, if you do it enough, people get wise to your schemes and say, hey, look, we're not going to do this anymore. And so Europe was trying to chart its own course, I think, in the early 2000s when, like, France and Germany opposed the war in Iraq. You know, there was the talk of the coalition of the willing and the coalition of the unwilling and all that. And, you know, that was when Putin was still closer to the European consensus. I think ultimately a lot of this is the fact that the United States is intentionally trying to drive these two countries apart, these two blocks apart. And maybe nobody realizes it, maybe. But I think that there is a chance now for people to realize this and don't take the bait. You know, realize that the voices both in the Russian regime and the European governments that want peace in this fashion, like what we had in 2021 and earlier, need to be enhanced. So one of the ways practically that this was done for the European Union is there was the Charlemagne Prize that was developed, the Charlemagne Award, for people that were pushing, you know, many different fields, but professionals who were pushing for broader European integration. I propose the Bismarck Prize, where you have you support broader European-Russian collaboration. That's literally how the European Union got the energy for this. They had these, you know, prizes that they would give out to professionals throughout the European landscape in order to push a certain narrative of cooperation. Now, that does not exist now for European-Russian collaboration, but it's called the Bismarck Prize. And you have people who are awarded that every year from Russia and Europe in order to for their work in encouraging such unity.
Now, again, I always try to anticipate what I think people might say in the comments, but also I'm going to kind of play Piers Morgan, quote unquote, a little bit here before we wrap up. I can guarantee you there'll at least be one person, okay, whether they're a real person or not, who'll be saying, the trouble is, Todd, you sound like a paid up Russian shill. You know, you quoted Dugin earlier on. You're on the payroll, or you're like you're basically using Moscow Kremlin talking points here. How do you respond to some? Because I guarantee you somebody will say that because you haven't, you know, your view here hasn't been Russia bad, bad, bad.
Oh, that's just because I'm a Bismarckian. I believe in broader bilateral agreements between Europe and Russia.
Okay. All right. I don't know if that will satisfy those voices, but, you know, somebody's bound to say it. So I'll just put it out there. I don't really know. I'll be honest. I don't really know what the answer to this particular issue is, because I can see what you're saying in theory, but I also, this is the thing, as long as, let's just call it, the Anglo-American interest is on the map. Okay, Britain may seem insignificant at the moment, but they're always there in the back channels, you know, little voice in the ear. They have been, our government have been the most psychotic when it comes to Russia. It was Boris Johnson who actually prevented the peace in April 2022. There's something about the British that's got a real vested interest in this war, in this conflict. I mean, that phrase, the coalition of the willing, Keir Starmer is meant to be the person to create the coalition of the willing. They see it as truly existential. And it's difficult because I can kind of see the reasons from the Mackinder thesis, etc. Because it's like, okay, this plan takes place that you're talking about, Todd, but now we're fucked. Now we're on the outside. Now the land powers won and the sea powers have been squeezed and made small. Great if you're Russian or German. What if you're sitting in London, or even more, what if you're sitting in Washington? now our plans have been ruined. You see what I mean? So this is why geopolitics is not so easy, because it's like you've always got to consider the other point of view. The other question, the last question I'll have as well, and this is just kind of came up as we were talking, is, okay, we do your plan. You've got United Europe now that goes all the way to the eastern border of Russia, bordering on China. Now you've created this, how do you not then replicate the problem that currently exists between Putin and Ukrainians, or Russia and Ukraine? You've now recreated it between this new United Europe and the Chinese, who are going to see an existential risk and an existential security threat on their West Coast now. And it's now the Chinese are going to be like, well, we don't want this Russian-led juggernaut on our left here. We're going to have to start screwing this up. We don't want that to happen. And then you get, I don't know, a new Mongol invasion or something crazy like this. Like, have you thought about that? Or is this too much in fantasy land?
Well, no. I mean, I think China's security landscape is different. And I think ultimately, depending on, again, if, let's just say, given for the next 10 to 15 years, China is going to have its hands full, not just with trying to break through the first island chain and the US-led alliance, but also India, which is a nation with a similar population size. So it would be hard for China to, I believe, mobilize forces along the Russian border, because they would all be at the expense of India and then Indochina, which is a part of the US bloc of Vietnam, and the US-led bloc in the first island chain. I mean, China would be completely contained at that point. I mean, I think at that point, India and the US would begin to collaborate with this power and just completely hold China up.
Mm-hmm. So the Chinese would be a bit buggered as well in this scenario.
Yeah, they probably would. That depends on if they can achieve success against the US before this happens.
I see. Oh, interesting things to consider. Interesting things to consider. My worry is for these sorts of plans is that, I mean, as I was talking about, when empires are in decline, forgive the language, they tend to spaz out. They tend to have a kind of go out in a blaze of glory, cause huge damage as they're going out. And I mean, in the case of if you want to put it this way, in the case of the British Empire, it took two world wars. Right. But the British had a significant role in starting both of those wars for various different reasons. And this is the big worry for the world is that, how big is the American spaz out going to be? You know, we haven't had the Suez yet. When we haven't had the spaz out yet, we may be seeing it. All this stuff about Greenland, the Venezuela thing was audacious. They keep on talking about Iran. You know, it seems like America is running around, at a rate of knots everywhere all at once. You know, it seems like, but it wants to show its home population, we're still strong. We're still number one. We still got it. We can still expand. Some part of MAGA, some part of Trump seems to be this. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. I would. I think that the U.S. is in, the sort of what you might call it, to use a card game analogy, and its death rattles. You lost two protracted conflicts, one in Vietnam, one in the Middle East over the last 80 years. A third one will be game over. I don't think you're going to walk away. And we saw this with Britain. They even won the Second World War and it was still game over for their empire. They just went down the tubes. The real question is...
One.
But the real question is the United States, is it a blowfish or not, right? How much of this is it like trying to appear to be big and powerful? And how much of it is it really that way? Because it's difficult to envision a full-scale invasion like 2003 of Iraq. Even in a war against China that they plan against, they're going to be collaborating with the South Koreans, the Japanese, the Taiwanese, the Filipinos. They're going to be doing a lot of what we might call it the grunt work, right? A lot of that. The U.S. will be more operating the sophisticated weapon systems. Now, sure, they could still do a lot of damage. And the real concern would be, is there a NATO-Russia war, which is what people are talking about. And that would be the final fruit, if you will, of the Atlanticist trap, within geopolitics. And Europe and Russia would probably not survive that.
Now, I have to ask you, just because it's in the news all the time, is this Greenland thing a real thing? Is it a concern? Is it going to split apart NATO? Is it a real security consideration? Is it of strategic importance? What the hell is the Greenland thing, Todd?
I really don't know. I really don't know. It sounds laughable on the face of it. Now, like, this could just be an elaborate kayfabe to, like, cover for, like, a purchase of Greenland. Like, the U.S. purchased the those islands in the Caribbean in 1917, the Virgin Islands, from Denmark. But if that's the case, why be so provocative? Why be so antagonistic? Yeah, I have no idea at all. I'll just answer with the risk meme. Venezuela, Alaska, Greenland. That's what's going on.
All right. Well, fascinating discussion, Todd. A lot of interesting what ifs. Where can people find you?
They can find me at POF Podcast on X and Praiseify Podcast on YouTube.
And I'll just remind everyone, promo code Shorjang gets you 25% off all courses. Buy it now, et cetera, et cetera. But most importantly of all, get out. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just 3 of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.